This is the Voice of Freedom.
Listen to me, as I'm telling you the truth, folks.
The acid test of a human being's freedom and will to protect the quality of his life lies in a person's attitude toward his oppressor.
We have seen our nation weighed in the balance of history and found wanting.
The empire feeds off the resources of the republic.
Can you count, suckers? I say the future is ours. If you can count.
The trouble with you and all of your crowd is when you dangle them on that worn-out string of ideas that should have been buried along with the guy that invented it.
The most amazing thing about the American people is that they are constantly defending their worst betrayers. If you want to see what is wrong with America today, go into your bathroom and look into the mirror. You will find the problem staring at you. The truth hurts.
Can you dig it?
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See, here on another Friday morning in America. Welcome to the Season 3 season finale that is actually taking place on a Friday morning in America. And I want to get to the business stuff up top before I get into the meat of things. Today is the official launch of the Come and See merch store. So you'll be able to get some of the new items available, like the Come and See Coffee, Behold a Dark Roast. That's a collaboration between Come and See and Black Forge Coffee. There'll also be t-shirts. I'm hoping to have stickers up there soon, but I'm still kind of getting that worked out. But if you want to get in on the pre-orders for the show, we're going to be doing pre-orders for about 2 weeks on the coffee, I think. And I think we're going to run pre-orders for 3 weeks on the t-shirts, just because I have a feeling there might be a bit more of a demand for the t-shirts, but I'm kind of still trying to feel things out. I've never attempted to sell a coffee before, so I'm very curious, but we'll probably be doing about 2 weeks for the coffee and 3 weeks for the t-shirts. And then I'll be sending out emails to everybody who put an order in to let you know whenever those get shipped. Also, if you would like to become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep cult, if you're a fan of the podcast and you would like to help support me financially, for example, this is how I make a living, and it would be nice to be able to pay my bills and buy food. So if you'd like to contribute financially to my ongoing existence and the continuation of this podcast, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And there's a few options there as far as tiers available for you. And now that we have merch and things of that nature, there'll be bonus content available for subscribers as well. One of the things that I'm going to be working on during the break is building up sort of a log of subscriber exclusive material for the people who pay for the show. So if that's something you're interested in, you can hop on over to Patreon and become a subscriber and a member of the illustrious Hep cult. Haven't gotten all the business stuff out of the way. I sort of struggled with what I wanted to close season three with. I mean, okay, full disclosure, I have an episode key. I lost that episode key. So there was a plan for the 35th episode of the season. I couldn't tell you what the fuck it was. And then I thought to myself, well, okay, let's build off of what we've been doing with the Nazis and such, and maybe we should talk about the cocaine coup and the establishment of narco-terrorism with Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel. And then I thought, that's a heavy thing to decide to do at the last minute. Maybe we should tack that on to season four, Mox. And then I was sort of at a loss for what I wanted to close out what's felt like a pretty good season on my end. I don't know how it was for you, but I was trying to go out on sort of a strong end, and I didn't want to just rant about something that makes me angry again. That seems like something that I do all the time, in my opinion. So I thought to myself, we talk a lot about the concept of leftist revolution on this show, particularly in the various Mox Speaks installments and things like that. We've talked about, you know, the labor movement and some things about leftist revolutionaries in South America and Eastern Europe, and all of that is fine. But we haven't talked a lot about revolutionary action here. Some of my feelings about revolutionary tactics here, because I also think that that's a thing that we as leftists get hung up on frequently, is the understanding that we are where we are, and while we can learn from history, sometimes we look backwards to our own detriment, particularly as I think American leftists, this is a failing that we experience, because so many of our best thinkers are people who've been dead for 50 fucking years. So it's difficult not to get caught in the past. But I think it's important to remember that the environment in which you are functioning as an activist, as an organizer, as a leftist, whatever, if that's what you are, I understand that I do have a segment of the audience that isn't of the left, and some of this may not be as of interest to you, but I do hope that in listening to this show with some amount of regularity, you do become somewhat aware of at least my political disposition, and I guess my best hope would be that some of it rubs off on you. And I find myself frequently, as a person who does what I guess you could call a unique form of organizing, that my stance on leftism and leftist organizing tends to be, I guess, at odds with a lot of other people's, but I've also found a lot of success, particularly in converting right-wingers. So I wanted to talk a bit about some of my feelings on leftist revolutionary tactics, some of the things that I try to do, some of the things that I recommend, and some of the things that I can't explicitly recommend because they're illegal, so we're going to talk about them in a historical context. Because, after all, I don't want to go to prison. So that's sort of a vague outline for what we're going to talk about today, because I think that one thing that helped me conceptualize this show being what it was, and it's a very tempered version of what I was trying to do with the four-cornered room. That was much more of a hammer to the face than anything else, which made it difficult to listen to and difficult to do all the way around, because it was a bit heavy. This tempers that a bit. And I do think it's necessary to not just swim in trauma porn all the time, I think that on the left, we have a tendency to study our own theory, our own political ideologies, our own political history, our own leaders. And while that's fine, it's also somewhat masturbatory and not beneficial beyond a certain point, in my opinion. So I personally, and something that I stress to other young people who are new to activism in particular, because I think that in the actual field is where I think some of this is important, as opposed to, for example, engaging in online debates with folks, although it is helpful for that too. You should study the right. You should study fascists. If you live in the United States, you should study white supremacy, because those are the people who run the country that you live in. If you ever really want to get to a point where you are in conflict of any sort, those are the people that you're going to be up against, and you should know more about the people you're fighting than dead people who had similar thoughts to you 120 years ago, in my opinion. So I've sort of, from around the age of 14 or 15 up until now, had a preoccupation with studying fascists, dictators, Nazis, neo-Nazis, Klansmen, white supremacists, conspiracy theorists, people of that nature, because I want to know how the people who want to kill me think. And in many ways, that's a big part of what this podcast is. It's a leftist perspective explaining the right to an audience in a way that I think is palatable, because I think this stuff, while absurd sometimes, is important to know. And in the same way that, as we have discussed, if you are a regular listener of the show, who's listened to our episodes where we've discussed right-wing American insurgency groups and domestic terrorists, many of these people studied Mao, and they learned a lot of the tactics that they employed studying authoritarian communist revolutions overseas. Because these are men, and they were men, let's be honest, who understood that they needed to know who their enemy was, and in their mind, their enemy was global communism. So they studied global communism. Well, in the same way, my enemies are fascism, imperialism, and white supremacy. So I study those things. And I think that in studying them, you both understand your adversary better, and there are things you can learn from studying your adversaries. For example, any fascist on the internet worth their salt understands the concept, but learned, I believe, originally from Louis Beam in the 1980s, of hiding your power level. And this is how they're able to recruit so easily, because they do not come out immediately and say, I'm a Nazi, I think we need to exterminate other ethnic groups, sign my recruitment form. Because that kind of thing turns off people who are even susceptible to agreeing with you. There's memes, there's subtext, there is an entire subculture of introductory propaganda dedicated to getting kids, and it is usually kids, from here laugh at this picture of Bugs Bunny to the Holocaust probably didn't really happen. And it's a finely tuned system because they've had almost 100 fucking years to work on it at this point. But that system exists. All they did in the last 30 years was move it onto the internet. And something that I noticed with a lot of leftists, and one of the reasons that I don't think leftism has ever taken off in the post-Hoover era in this country, is everyone is so up their ass to let you know, I am a communist. I think Stalin had a lot of really good ideas, and the way to fix everything is to convince everyone else Stalin had a lot of really good ideas. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't think Stalin had a lot of really good ideas. I'm not saying there's anything inherently wrong with being a communist. What I am saying is you should understand your environment and that the United States of America has conditioned the general public for well over 100 years to be suspicious of collectivism and view communism as antithetical to all of America's values. So when you start your recruitment pitch with, I am a communist and I think everyone needs to be a communist, you've alienated 75 to 80% of your audience outright. The same can be said of anarchism in the way that anarchism is portrayed in media, which is most people's interaction with anarchism. That, or the fact that the last time most people who ingest mainstream media heard the word anarchist, it was in relationship to right-wing insurgents on January 6th. So if you pitch yourself as an anarchist, well, you want to upset the order, and maybe you do. But everyone doesn't view that as a good thing. And you're trying to recruit, remember. You need numbers for this populist revolution that you're attempting to achieve. And you don't get those by alienating the majority of the base, which is what most of us are doing most of the time. Even on a political level, you need to understand that the average American is working class, not an academic, and not interested in labels in the way that we present them. Something that I thought was very, very interesting, that while I would never vote for the cat because I don't vote anymore, I took a lot away from this. And I believe the 2016 presidential primary cycle, Bernie Sanders went on Fox News. I know. Let me finish. Bernie Sanders went on Fox News and he described socialized medicine. He described a public option. He described a social democratic platform to a live audience on Fox News. And he didn't use any of those words. He just described what he wanted to do. And he found that the majority of the Fox audience supported the ideas. Because when you don't use words that have been poisoned by hours upon hours upon hours of propagandized media, things that benefit the general public benefit the general fucking public. They've just been programmed, and I hate to use that word because it has such a connotation to it, but they have been so programmed, predisposed, if you will, to immediately view words like communist, leftist, social, welfare, any of those things, public for that matter, as that's a gateway to socialism. Socialism and communism are the same thing. The communists want to destroy the country and take our freedom. It's that ingrained. They had an entire political movement dedicated to the eradication of leftism in government in the 1950s. J. Edgar Hoover's entire purpose in the federal government was wiping out radical leftism, and he did it very, very effectively. And we just decided to teach that entire period in history differently so no one would understand how much of it was related to solidarity with communist countries, to be perfectly honest with you. And beyond the feeling of the general public, you're talking about a country with a government, if this is your intent to invoke revolution, if you will, for legal purposes. You're talking about a government that, after fighting Germany, specifically because Germany allied itself with Japan and Japan fucked with us once after we had fucked with them for over a decade, after fighting Germany, Russia beat them, but fighting Germany and attempting to wipe part of Japan off the map strictly just to scare the Soviet Union, and then helping funnel fascist commandos into other countries to fight communism for most of the 70s and 80s and part of the 90s, between, you know, the what we talked about on Wednesday, and also the Contras and the Honduran death squads and what we did in Peru and everything else. And of course, the fact that we spent most of the 60s and half of the 70s in Vietnam, strictly because we didn't want communism that close to us. We cut off trade with Cuba for, when did we do that? 1976? 80? Somewhere in there. It might have been in the 80s. Maybe it was the 90s. I don't actually know because I don't have any notes in front of me. I'm literally just going off the top of my head today, full disclosure. But we cut off trade with Cuba after the communist revolution in Cuba. So one of the stated objectives of the territory in which you're working, your base of operations, your home front, if you will, has been funding the eradication of your political ideology. And you think putting on a Ushanka and handing out copies of Marx is going to fix this country? You're out of your fucking mind. What you need, and this is the thing, I see a lot of leftists, particularly white leftists, which I find infuriating, but that's a whole other story for another day. I see a lot of white leftists in particular invoking the Black Panthers and the work of Fred Hampton and the Panthers in regards to, well, this was an organization that was Maoist, and look at all of the things that they did. They educated people on Maoism. Sure. How did they get there? They didn't go out into impoverished neighborhoods and try to hand out copies of the Red Book specifically. They sold copies of the Red Book to college students because Fred wasn't no fool. But the point is, to get to the point where you can educate the people on theory and ideology, where they feel like there's any reason to give a fuck about what you have to say, you need to show the community that you're worth listening to. What did the Panthers do first? Law classes for a group of people who were being persecuted by the police because they were ignorant of the law. Food, lunch programs, free breakfast, armed escort in certain cases. We'll stand there with you while you're being fucked with by the cops so you don't die. After a while, you look at this group of people who are improving your community and you ask yourselves, what the fuck's going on over there? Ironically, it's exactly how Christians teach each other to evangelize. You do so through works. Faith through works. The idea that people will know you're a Christian by watching you act like one, you don't have to tell them. The same is true of what is essentially a sociopolitical ideology based on empathy for the human experience and the planet we all live on as a living and breathing thing. So there's some overlap there in terms of what the goals are supposed to be. I'm not talking about the Vatican. I'm talking about the Jewish Buddhist guy. If you want to look at an idea for here is how you get people to appreciate how what you're trying to give them can improve their material conditions and their community, start improving their material conditions and their communities. Telling people to read books doesn't do anything but make you look like a know-it-all asshole. And poor people with no food don't need a know-it-all asshole. They need cereal. So show up with cereal and tell them about marks after they've eaten. If they ask, be a presence within the community. Figure out what your community needs. Maybe you live in a neighborhood where there ain't that many hungry people, and bless you if you do. Maybe what you need is community defense. Maybe you need a neighborhood watch. Maybe you need a community presence to keep certain elements like the pigs out of your neighborhood all the fucking time. Maybe you need someone to make sure that women aren't being trafficked. Maybe you live in an area with a lot of bars where that kind of thing happens. There are needs in your community that you can fill for the betterment of your community that show people the benefit of your beliefs without you needing to scream about your fucking beliefs all the time. A lot of leftists have been surprised to learn that I have a lot of success talking to right-wingers, particularly right-wing militiamen, as a militant black leftist. The fact is, we have more in common than we don't, and if you present that to them in a way that is not intended to be confrontational, they understand that. Look, I've worked in factories half my fucking life. I'm from a working class town. I understand why you're angry. I'm angry for all of the same reasons you are. The difference is, someone told you the reason you're fucked is me. But it's not. It's them. Them what have all the money. Them what never do any of the work. Them what told you that you should be making more money than me even if we're doing the same job. Why are you and I arguing over $5 while this motherfucker makes 500,000% what both of us make combined a year to send emails and make phone calls and tell us we gotta work on Christmas? The problem is not your fellow worker, my dude. Your problem is your boss, and your boss's boss, and the oil company that funds the company that he owns. If you relate to people as people, you have more success than shouting down theory in academic, clinical terms most people are not even fucking aware of. Look, I can do that with you all day. It doesn't get anyone anywhere. I can talk to you about dialectical materialism. It's so much easier to just say, you should understand your fucking environment. Because when I say, you should understand your fucking environment, everyone knows what I mean, and I don't have to take 5 minutes to explain that Stalin wrote an essay about dialectical materialism in the 19-teens, or whatever the fuck he wrote it. It's unnecessary, is my general point. And I think that with education in the United States being of such a necessity, to make education something that appears to be elitist and unavailable to the general working class person is at cross purposes. Because if you ever want to start an army, there's way more working class people than anyone else. It's the same reason you shouldn't just openly criticize religion for the sake of criticizing religion. Most people are religious. There is a very, very specific group of parasitic white identity, bad faith agent provocateurs who call themselves evangelical fundamentalist Christians in this country. But that doesn't mean that there is a problem inherent in the Christian faith any more than there is in the Jewish faith or Islam or you know, some of the others, there are faiths that I would say that there's inherently a problem with. Like, if you're a Scientologist, you should probably go see a doctor. But the point that I'm making is that if you want a mass organization, you need to understand your audience. And there are certain things that you see inherent in a lot of leftist discourse that immediately turn off most people. So if you actually want to appeal to most people, you know, the proletariat, you should understand who the proletariat is. And while I do think educating the masses is important, you need to understand who you're educating and how to do so. I do think that we as a society suffer on a mass level from a lack of ability to grasp critical thinking, something that I think is intentionally not taught to people as children. And part of that is because critical thinking makes propaganda a whole hell of a lot easier to see through, and they don't want you to see through propaganda, so they don't teach you how. And I think that for that reason, because we're never going to overhaul state education, we should really start looking at leftist schooling collectives of some sort as an alternative, where you, almost as like a co-op collective sort of a situation, like a home schooling, maybe a schoolhouse situation, where several qualified individuals, and this is another thing that I want to talk about is, well, I'll get to that in a second, but that you need the ability to educate people young, and I think those environments need to be intentionally diversified so that people don't grow up in these homogenized vacuum environments indoctrinated by state-funded education that tells you American exceptionalism is a real thing. I mean, it's a real thing, but you know what I mean. That tells you that you should embrace American exceptionalism. This country has never done anything wrong. Once upon a time, there were Indians here, and now we have a few left in museums. Black people came over to help farm, and now everything is fine. We elected one of them. Don't ask any questions about the Jews or the Chinese. And, you know, then we found oil and everything was great, or whatever the fuck they put in history books these days. So to combat that, I really think you need to start setting up your own educational system. You know, I talked about this very, very briefly in regards to how I think you achieve black determinism on the episode where we discussed white segregated education. I don't think we get where we need to go by relying on the state. I know that there's a lot of people who would argue that what you need to do is establish another state. I would tell you that all you're going to do is the exact same thing that you already did over again. And you won't agree with me, and you'll try it, and you'll fail, and then everything will be fine. But I think that if you're going to try to overhaul education, as just a for example, the state doesn't want smarter people. In the United States of America, they do not want smarter people in this country. Smarter people are harder to control. They literally said that when they set up the educational system the way that it's set up in this country. So why would they fix it? This is part of a larger problem that I have with how a lot of people conceive, quote unquote, fixing America. You're not fixing anything. It's not broken. This is what it is. This is what it does. It's a mechanized organism maintenanced by venture capitalists for the purposes of deregulating markets for the furtherance of free market capitalism. Everything else is a byproduct of that. The fascism, the weird theocratic shit, all of that is a reaction to the massive poverty brought on by the American system, because only a very, very small number of people have ever and will ever get to be successful here. and that number will continue to shrink over time. So things that appeal to disenfranchised poor people have a huge foothold in this country because most of us are disenfranchised and poor. Everything is a byproduct of that. The fact that everyone is depressed and addicted to things and constantly cycling through ways to try to make themselves feel better about all of this stuff. The fact that everyone feels like they need guns, the fact that everybody thinks that they need to be on pills, all of this shit is related to this system over here, which is, again, not broken. It's functioning the way it's fucking supposed to. Because if it wasn't, the people in charge of it would be spending lots and lots and lots of money to fix it. That they aren't tells you there's nothing wrong. So the problem isn't figuring out where the system is broken and amending that. The problem is the system. So you do not overhaul education in the American system. You figure out a way to educate yourself outside of it, because it will never accommodate you in such a way for you to achieve determinism separate from the system, because the system doesn't benefit from that. I when you say it, it sounds simple, but it's remarkable how few people this actually occurs to. So you need separate as much of everything as humanly possible. I mean, there are limitations, and we're going to talk about that again when we talk about the lack of certain kinds of professionals in a lot of organizational structures. But I think that in addition to that separate education, like I said earlier, there needs to be a serious focus on studying the literature of those who oppose you. I think that reading about fascism is extraordinarily important because it helps you understand that fascism is different everywhere. In much the same way that we discussed earlier, that you need to understand your environment and tailor your approach to it, you need to understand that your opposition has already done that. Another thing that I think that a lot of people on the left don't understand whenever you get involved in any kind of organization, any kind of activism, but particularly community defense or proactive anti-fascist work, you need to understand that they started a lot earlier than we did. They've had a lot more time and legal federal protection in most cases to get bigger, well-funded, well-organized, and dispense a lot of information over the last 40 to 50 fucking years. So we are at a disadvantage in terms of how long they've been at this at a high organizational level. But with that understanding, you can copy some of that infrastructure. And we're also going to talk about some tactics and techniques that I think are useful a little bit later on in the episode. I told you we're really going to get into it today. But I think that you need to study some of the people whose names we've discussed on the show in greater detail. Some of the literature is difficult to get your hands on because it is, well, hate speech in many cases. But Revillo P. Oliver, even more so than the Turner Diaries, although I do think if you can stomach the language, the Turner Diaries are an important piece of literature for you to read. It sucks as a book. It's also been an instruction manual for literally hundreds of right-wing insurgents. Read Unintended Consequences. Timothy McVeigh, one of the people who is absolutely obsessed with the Turner Diaries, said that if he had read Unintended Consequences before the Oklahoma City bombing, he probably wouldn't have used a bomb. He would have used a sniper rifle. So if you want to look at the current era of domestic terrorism, because that is what all of these mass shootings are, the news won't call it domestic terrorism, but that's what it is. A lot of these cats built their what they did off of reading certain books, following certain people. You should be aware of those people. You should also be aware of how these people dress, the insignia that they use. Going back to the establishment of the Klan, these are cats who used hand signals, their own language, all of these things, just like street gangs, just like secret societies, which is really what street gangs are. You have to understand the language that these people are using. You need to know what to look for. As an on-the-ground activist, I, a few years ago, found myself in several situations where there were new kinds of right-wing extremists at rallies, at actions, at public events. And most of the organizers and the other people at these events didn't know what they were seeing. Why are there people dressed up like clowns? What does that mask mean? Why are they all doing that with their hands? These are things you should be aware of, because they're communicating and you should know what they're fucking saying. It's understanding your enemy. It's of utmost importance if you don't want to get hurt out there. And I also think that everybody should read Mao. I do, because frankly, as many of them studied guerrilla tactics and insurgent tactics and the Little Red Book from Chairman Mao, I think that that's important reading. Also, I just think he had a lot of great ideas, to be perfectly honest with you. Moving on from that, I wanted to discuss some specific forms of action, some different techniques, tactics, things of that nature. Just some things that I think are useful to people who may be wanting to get involved in any sort of direct action of any kind. For mass organization, you really riot through labor. You know, whether you're talking about the American labor movement, the Sandinistas, there are many different examples of radical action through labor. And listen, before you immediately respond with, "I can't afford to do that," I understand, neither can I. We're already not making enough money to survive. So in order to implement something like a general strike, a mass strike, mass action of some kind, what you need are food storehouses. You need gas storage. You need backups of essential materials so that you have the ability to take a week and say, "We are not buying any gas this week. None of us are going to the grocery store this week." These sorts of, you need a base from which to build mass action. And that starts with having the things available to the people that they'll be going without during a boycott. So you like I was saying earlier, in terms of looking at what your community needs and addressing those needs directly, food pantries, gas storage, bunkers, things of that nature, communal spaces for the storage of non-perishable goods and things that you may need if you decide to cut capitalism off at the knees for a month or so. Everyone noticed how different things functioned when all of the businesses stopped making money 2 years ago, right? How malleable things became in an economic and political sense, when suddenly lots of people who were used to a constant flow of cash weren't getting that constant flow of cash, and how open to negotiation they became in terms of things like giving everybody like $800 a week for 3 months. These are the things you have to plan for, and it is something you have to plan for. You don't just all wake up and decide, "We're not going to go to work for a month." These were communal actions whenever they were committed by the labor movement. And you, one of the issues that I think we have as Americans is we've, or they've, I should say, really transformed the idea of what community is in the last several decades to make things like organization significantly more difficult, because you know more about people you've never met in other states than you know about your fucking neighbors. And community is one of those things where you need to know the people who are around you to have an understanding of the environment in which you are working. I had a fan of the show maybe a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. Longtime fan of the Four Cornered Room and some of my online activity. I've been very, very vocal about my opposition to gentrification and white people with money moving into black neighborhoods, for example. This person had done that as a white person, moved into a black neighborhood where they didn't know anyone, they had money, that kind of a thing. We're going to yada, yada, yada some of this. A group of black teenagers stole this person's car. And the question presented to me, the black person who was supposed to be giving the advice in this scenario, was it wrong of me to call the police? Yes, it's always wrong to call the police. In this particular situation, the response was, well, but how would I get my car back? Well, this is where you need to know your neighbors, because someone in the community knows those boys and knows whose parents, like, knows their grandmother, knows where they hang out, knows what playground they go to, and knows where they probably took the car. But because you're not from that community and not from that neighborhood, that's not an option available to you. This is why you need to know the community that you live in. Because when you're not part of the community can decide to take things from you because you're a rube and it's easy. In the same way, you need to understand the environment that you're working in. You need to know your neighbors and where they work and their families and form a sense of unity on a social level with the people in your immediate vicinity. So whenever it is time to come together as a community, you know who the other people are. And when you have a base from which to do that and formulate that empathy of circumstance, oh, that's Joe, his wife's sick, we should take dinner over tomorrow. Those kinds of things. That sense of, I know you, I understand who you are, I understand where you're coming from, and we are in this together. Community, if you will. A fantastic prelude to communalism, or communism, if you'd rather, whatever. But I think that mass strike is something that's often overlooked as a possibility because we are also wage-whipped to the point that taking a day off of work usually means you'll be homeless by the end of the month. But it's that sense of community and that community safety net that you create that allows people to take those kinds of risks. As long as we rely on the state for that help, we will only ever get enough to just barely be able to make it and never even think about doing anything other than what we're doing. And again, that's a function of the state. You shouldn't ask your slave master for your freedom. You should take it. So in addition to mass action through labor, I think that there's something to be said for infiltration in certain lines of occupation. You know, I had a really long discussion with someone about this very recently in regards to the Occupy movement and how it frustrated the living fuck out of me. That was an early time period in activism, street activism for me. And seeing people, you know, we talked about the Spartacists the other day and how it sort of disillusioned an entire group of people to radical leftism, to see radical leftists kind of step up and not have a plan. Occupy was very much the same thing. And really, a lot of the neo-fascist provocateurs that you saw in the alt-right were a direct result of disenfranchisement from the failure of the Occupy movement. And I bring that up to say that the Occupy movement would have been infinitely more successful if, rather than playing Frisbee across the street, people had pooled funds to buy stocks to get onto the stock floor, and then you have yourselves in the building. And you can do all kinds of things in the building. You know, we all hate pigs. Well, I shouldn't say we all. There's probably even a few of you listening. Oink, oink, sir. But most of us, reasonable people, people with dignity and common sense, hate pigs. But what's useful and what has helped the right for years and years and years, and we all know this if we go to street rallies because you can see it on their tattoos, they started putting people in the pigs decades ago so that they know where the pigs are. They know what they're going to do. They have representation. If anything is going to happen, there's a likelihood that one of them is going to show up and make sure nobody gets any serious charges for anything. They have people on the inside. And there's plenty of industries where that's a beneficial thing to do for various reasons in Minecraft, for whatever reason, hypothetically. There's benefit to having people who work for the bank. There's benefit to having people on housing boards. There's benefit to having people on the educational committees. There's benefit to having people who are teachers, doctors, nurses, all of these lines of work that we associate with the establishment because that's usually who works in them. It shouldn't be. Because one of the ways that you keep a population controlled is, for example, making everybody afraid to go to the fucking doctor. You can enforce, you look at the structure of white supremacy and imperialism in the United States. Well, not imperialism abroad, but the structure of the United States and how it controls the population. It's many, many, many layers that have been established over time, reinforced. It's the education, it's the housing, it's the medicine, it's the food, it's the clothing, it's everything. All of these things together, which lock you into a multifaceted prison from which you can't even begin to think how to extricate yourself. Well, one of the things you need is leftist doctors, leftist lawyers, leftist nurses, leftist pediatricians, people who aren't going to shame children whenever they think that they might be trans. You need that infrastructure, particularly in medicine, because if you're ever going to have any form of revolution, one of the first things you're going to realize that you no longer have access to is medicine. Because there's nothing in the United States of America more capitalist than the pharmaceutical industry. So you need people with access to those things. One of the things that I was saying whenever the Roe v. Wade argument was happening earlier this year is that you didn't need to go to protests and have rallies. I understood the reason for that, and I was perfectly fine getting my ass kicked working security at those things. But what you needed was people who were going to start stockpiling the necessary medications, the necessary things for certain kinds of health care that were going to be harder to get. Of course, certain kinds of medication you can't stockpile because they do have an expiration date, but within reason, you need to figure out, like I said earlier, find the needs of the community and meet those. Be the one who is available when the community needs you, and the community will understand your importance because you will have made yourself important. I mentioned the difference in society during the lockdowns, whenever businesses weren't making money. Another thing that I think a lot of people could have and should have taken away from the quarantines and the lockdown period was the inability of the federal government to address problems in an effective way at all, and how we as individual groups, regions, communities, however you want to word it, should have realized that meant we needed to be prepared on a social level for these kinds of things in the future, because there wasn't going to be any help coming. Here's your opportunity. The government's not coming. Where's the water coming from? Who's doing the things in the community that need to be done, that demonstrate to the people that there is an option available to them better than the one that they already have? Because if it's not you, it will be someone else, or it will be no one, and everyone will just continue to be miserable. And sure, all of that is difficult. All of that is time-consuming. All of it is psychologically taxing. But so is what we're doing now. You know, there's a point at which you have to say that, you know, a temporary misery for the possibility of determinism and emancipation may or may not be worth it. And to that point, a furtherance of tactics, small groups, cadets, cats, and kittens, small groups, less than 13. Anything larger than 13, you should assume someone you don't want in that room is in that room. And preferably people you already knew and have the ability to remain in contact with. So if, for example, a new person shows up in their life wanting to talk to them about what your group does during meeting time, everyone will know. Shared housing also makes that a whole lot easier, but I understand that there are circumstances in which that is not available. But small groups, infiltration is one of the easiest ways to break up any leftist group. We're a group that likes to fight amongst ourselves, what can I say? So sowing division is extraordinarily easy, so it's best to keep the groups small. If you get anything larger than 13, start a new group. Then you've got two leftist groups in town as opposed to one big one. And then before you know it, you've got several small cells. Also entirely decentralized. This leaderless resistance thing that the right does is extraordinarily effective, and for that reason, I think that it's something that you should pay attention to. The idea that there is no party or chairman or party leader that everyone is immediately responsible to specifically. It is an understood general goal that everyone is doing their part to achieve, and therefore you cannot dismantle the machine because one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing and so forth. That is extraordinarily effective. We've discussed it in the past. It's the concept of leaderless resistance. It was theorized by both Louis Beam and David Lane, affiliated with the Order in the 1970s and 1980s. But it's an older idea than that. I believe Mao basically had a form of leaderless resistance as an idea as well. But decentralized individual cells of less than 12 for community service purposes, community defense purposes, community education purposes, feed, house, and security. And the people will come to you I promise. I also recommend the use of shortwave radio. I think that our reliance on social media and even quote-unquote encrypted text services makes everyone extraordinarily vulnerable to having communications monitored. You know, if you paid any attention to what happened on after January 6th, there was a lot of people who communicated with Signal texts who were in prison because the federal government read their Signal texts. Shortwave is not something that you can necessarily trace, particularly if you designate a frequency that other people are not going to be using, or you alternate frequencies every couple of days, maybe mix up the pattern in such a way that only you and your 10 friends are aware of. That sort of thing is a lot more effective than posting on a Facebook group that you're all going to be meeting at the Starbucks about going down and smashing up a Target, for example. Those kinds of things, that way lies prison. And you also have to be aware of agent provocateurs. That when you advertise events in places that people you may not want at your events can see them, those people can show up and they've been trained on how to manipulate crowd activity. I've watched this happen with my own eyes. And that brings me to another point that I think is important. In addition to studying fascism and white supremacy and the works of the right wing, I think you should study the military. You know, military field manuals are extraordinarily easy to get your hands on, both in PDF form or in physical form, on the internet, on Amazon, in surplus stores, and they're cheap. Books on guerrilla warfare, on tactical medicine, on psyops, on tactical evasion, on guerrilla tactics. There's lots of different field manuals available to you, full of lots and lots of useful information. Another book that I can't recommend enough to you is The Poor Man's James Bond. The Poor Man's James Bond was written as a right-wing insurgency manual that is, for some reason, not banned, but it's full of incredibly useful tidbits, like field medicine is an aspect of it, but making incendiaries out of household items, like how to turn a light bulb into a grenade that's in there, how to turn a select fire, how to turn a semi-automatic into an automatic weapon, things like that. Lots of useful tidbits, and again, it's not a banned book. For some reason, there's also PDFs available all over the internet, but I recommend The Poor Man's James Bond. If you've read The Anarchist Cookbook and thought that was useful, you will love The Poor Man's James Bond. I will say that much. There's also numerous guides on survivalism, on field medicine, on how to identify useful medicinal herbs and roots that I think you should read. Those kinds of things are useful because another thing that we've discussed, or we haven't discussed, but I've discussed with people privately, is that in the event of a quote-unquote revolt, if people have to go to hunting and gathering their own food, we've contaminated enough of this shit that there's almost nothing you can just pick up and eat anywhere as far as animals or potable drinking water or any of that sort of shit. So you really need to understand purification, those kinds of things, how to properly field strip animals and cook things. These are all useful skills and all things that, to go back to what I was saying about community, can be learned as a group. I offer gun safety and self-defense courses because those are things that I think are important, particularly for the non-male people in my community. I live and have lived in areas where trafficking, abuse, and things of that nature are of an extraordinarily high number, so it's important, in my opinion, to offer to the community safety. And that extends beyond my immediate community. Safety is something that I think is important for people in general. So safety is something that I attempt to offer when and where I am able to do so. Because community doesn't just extend to the people directly next to you. It's everybody. If you want a mass movement, you have to think big, which means understanding that there's lots of different kinds of people, figuring out how they're similar, and appealing to that. And one of the ways that they're similar is mass disenfranchisement, because they live here. And fear, because they're pumped full of fear propaganda on the evening news. And if they're non-male, they're literally stalked and hunted by people from the moment they wake up until the moment they go to bed, and in some cases while they're sleeping. So protection, safety, security is important. Food, always important. Get a job at a fucking soup kitchen. Not a job, but, you know, volunteer at a fucking soup kitchen. All of these things. Make yourself valuable to your community, and your community will come to you. And when we have the ability to organize in that way, we can actually accomplish things that I'm not going to get into in any serious detail right now. Other things that I think are beneficial for people who are attempting to engage in forms of destabilization, if that's a thing you've ever considered doing in Minecraft or writing a story about, for example, hypothetically. Passive action, counterfeit bills. That's not something that I'm recommending that you do, obviously. Counterfeiting money is a felony and extraordinarily difficult to do because they have, like, the blue hundreds these days and all that other bullshit. But if you remember our episode on an abridged episode of American Fascism, one of the ways that the Order, which I believe they got from the Turner Diaries, sought to destabilize the United States government was circulating large quantities of counterfeit bills, because the Order believed that was a useful way to disrupt the American economic system. So, if you were studying the Order as a group that successfully disrupted the American economic system on some level, they did, after all, steal like $4.5 million, they printed counterfeit bills. Something to note, I guess. Again, it's also important, I think, to look at small actions in lots of places happening at one time. Because those are really, really useful for splitting up. If you remember the police riots, their ability to consolidate force in a single place with coordination, especially in situations where they had routes for the groups that they were monitoring, if you can separate them, for example, hypothetically speaking, if you had 7 rallies planned for the same day and they all had permits, because that's how you legally and lawfully exercise your right to protest as a citizen of the United States of America. Bless. If you had 7 groups with 7 permits, each one of those has to have a police detail to monitor. Just a thought. You can do with that what you will. And also, I think that it's important to remember, and this is a thing that I've discussed privately, especially because I've gotten requests about it in the past. We don't need any more politicians. We also don't need any more figureheads or ideologues or talking heads or pundits. You need people who are going to do shit. The last thing you need is another person who is attempting to be in charge of a movement. We don't need marching orders from a person who is in charge. And the last thing you should do is trust someone who tells you that they have a plan. I understand that that's a little bit ironic coming from a person who is literally talking to you about plans, but whatever. If a person comes to you and says that you should put me in charge, tag me in, coach, the last thing you should do is put them in the game. You'll never see the ball again. And they don't have your interests in mind. Whether we're talking about Bernie or AOC or who the fuck ever, none of these people give a fuck about you. If they have This is another one that's going to sound really funny and ironic considering what day it is. If they have their name on t-shirts that they're trying to sell you, then their intentions aren't genuine when they tell you that they're trying to start a movement for the people. I guess that's my out. I'm not trying to start a movement of any kind. I am doing what I can to try to make things as much better for people as I think is humanly possible with the abilities that I have, but I'm not interested in starting or running or leading anything. And to that point, we don't need any more leaders. We don't need any more politicians. We don't need any more presidents. We don't need to involve ourselves in their process, in their system, at all anymore. On a local level, you can argue with me that politics are important, and I wouldn't even disagree with you, but it's on a local level that you should be active in the first place. So do the things in your neighborhoods, do the things in your towns, do the things in your communities. Fuck politics. I also think that that's an important thing in rapping that we misconstrue in a lot of conversations. A lot of this stuff isn't political. Feeding, housing, and taking care of people, educating people, making sure that people feel safe, that's not political. It's social. Politics is legislation and policy and taxes and things of that nature that I couldn't be arsed to give a fuck about if I absolutely had to because my life depended on it. I care about people. Politics can go fuck itself. And we don't need any more politicians. You need community leaders, community organizers, community activists. We need you to get out there and do things. It's kind of like cutting it down to the wire at this point. So when you observe the country as it is, the misery, the poverty, the dysphoria of the average American, because, well, you know why. You need to understand that being a leftist, at least to me, maybe you don't need to understand this. Maybe I need you to understand this about me. Perhaps that's a better way to frame this. I'm not a leftist because I want to win arguments. I'm a leftist because I have hope. Because I have empathy for other people's human experiences, and because I believe there are better ways to do things than the way we do them now. And yes, sometimes the implementation of those things may require violence, but the point is, I look at an environment where people are cold outside and I want them to be warm, and I look at hungry people and I want them to be fed. That's why I'm a leftist. Not because someone dropped a really dope book on me in college. That these ideas are internal to me. I very much believe them. And I think that it is important to... No, I'll word that differently. You have to really believe this shit. I'll explain. You know, we talked in the first season about COINTELPRO. And that's an interesting story. It's a fascinating time period in history. It's also a cautionary tale about how not an acute way to put on a t-shirt. These are dangerous beliefs in the country that you live in, if you live in the United States. Or Canada, or Britain, or France, or any number of other places. But particularly in the United States, these are dangerous ideas to have here. Trying to make yourself the face of a movement because you want to be a YouTube personality or something is an easy way to get yourself killed for absolutely no reason whatsoever. You shouldn't want to be the leader of a movement. People become the leader of a movement when they die, in many cases. Your goal should be to live. And the purpose of my personal beliefs is a deep seated desire, need, to use the word again, hope, that things can be, should be, and will be better than they are. And I hope to help bring about that change socially through example. Maybe this was like a really, really long way for me to say that. I think that the left could do with a bit more show and prove sometimes. And with that, I want to extend a happy Hanukkah to those members of the audience, a Merry Christmas to those members of the audience, because that's in a couple of days. Those of you who celebrate the solstice, I hope that was wonderful as well. Any and everything that you celebrate, I hope that it was wonderful. If you celebrate nothing at all, I hope you got stoned. And if you don't get stoned, I hope you fucked. I want to thank everyone who has gone along on this gonzo journey from February of this year. I believe the first episode of the show dropped on Valentine's Day. So from Valentine's Day to Christmas, I think like 70 episodes of a podcast. There are people in Iceland and Israel and the Netherlands and Bolivia listening to this right now, and that is absolutely fucking mind-blowing to me. I love you all. Thank you very much. I want to thank all of you who have been here since the very beginning. I want to thank all of you who've picked up along the way and started at the beginning. And when you get here, hi. I will miss all of you while I'm gone. And I will see all of you in time for Black History Month, when we kick off season fucking 4 of how has it been a year and there's three, Jesus Christ. There's also been almost, there's going to be 100 episodes before the end of the next season of the show. That's, Jesus, maybe I should slow down or something. I don't even do any uppers anymore, man. This is just how it is. This is just what it is. You live and you learn and then you get loves, I guess. Anyway, we will be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. I'm not sure what the next episode of the show is going to be about, because it's like 6 weeks from now. But I promise to make it worth your while. In the meantime, to quote another great American, Jerry Springer, take care of yourselves and each other, everybody, and concentrate on the HEP. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you HEP cats on the flip side. Smooches. Deuces, dig it.
Finished.